ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you want to know who's really responsible for Donald Trump becoming president? It's Alan Funt. Yes. He's the man who invented reality TV, kind of by bugging people.
There was something kind of pervy and boundary crossing that isn't easy to sentimentalize.
I'm Mark Fennell, and that is just one exceptionally weird individual who changed the course of history, but trust me, there are more, and you'll hear about them. Just search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
Coming to you from the lands of the Kulin Nation on ABC Radio National, this is Life Matters. Hello, I'm Beverly Wang. Parents, before you had kids, did you have a clear vision of what kind of parent you were going to be and high expectations of your future offspring's perfect behavior? And what about afterwards? At what point did those pie-in-the-sky visions require some pretty drastic redesigning? It's humbling, isn't it? But also so very eye-opening. Pop Culture Parenting's Dr. Billy Garvey is with me, and you're sharing your parenting turning points. And in about 40 minutes' time, the aunties assemble to referee a clash with the in-laws. Let's talk. I had a very clear parenting turning point when my daughter was a toddler. She had a tantrum. I had a tantrum. It was a horrible mess. And in the aftermath, I felt really awful. I had a lot of regrets. I felt shame. I didn't want it to happen again. And that led to some really serious soul searching. I had to ask myself what I was trying to achieve as a parent in that moment. And I realized I was trying to win and have the upper hand in that interaction. And also that I had seriously unrealistic expectations of compliant behavior from a very young child. And that made me really dig deep and interrogate what lay behind this fixation of mine of winning an argument with a toddler. Because even as I say it, I know that sounds absurd. Because if the result of trying to win is two people screaming and upset, well, actually, that is losing big time. So I had to change and let go of that zero-sum winning mentality. And I also had made a very intentional decision as a parent to start modeling how to say sorry, how to apologize. And I know you will want to have a chance to call in and speak to my guest, because last time he was on, the phones just went bananas. He's got a lot of fans. Dr. Billy Garvey is a developmental pediatrician at one of Australia's largest pediatric hospitals with over 20 years of experience working with children. He's also the co-founder of the Pop Culture Parenting Podcast and the author of 10 Things I Wish You Knew About Your Child's Mental Health. And he is also a father of three. Dr. Billy Garvey, welcome back to Life Matters.
Hi, Beverly. It's great to be with you again.
It's so good to have you back. Now, Billy, let's get a bit personal. I started the show with a small confession about my parenting sort of crossroads, my initial aspirations colliding with the reality, and also having to think about the kind of baggage I was carrying that made me think about that. I wonder if you have had any similar moments that you'd care to share.
Yeah, definitely. And I thought it was beautiful, Beverly, because the biggest influence on how we parent is how we were parented. That doesn't mean we copy it, but for a lot of people we go, that's how I was brought up and I turned out fine. Unfortunately, mental illness rates in adults is really high, and we know that 50% of mental illness in adults starts before you're 14. So a lot of us have had these kind of childhood experiences where our parents are doing the best they could, but we know much more now about how to support these kids. But I've certainly had those experiences, and you also demonstrated one of the best things we can do as parents is what's called reflective practice in how am I going, just stopping and thinking, how am I going, how's this kid going, how's our partnership going, and the ability to say, I'm battling, I'm trying to win, this is not great, is pretty impressive that you can do that given everything else that you're juggling. So, you're probably doing a bit better than I am, because I
don't think so, yeah. Billy. Come on.
Well, I'm supposedly an expert every single day in a hospital, and, you know, we have a baby clinic and I love it. It's my favorite clinic of the week. And then I come home and I struggle with my own three. And it's actually mainly me struggling with myself and my own ability to regulate and not get frustrated and keep my own mental health in check and things like that. And it has an impact on my relationship with my kids. So I work on that every day personally.
I think when you say, yeah, we're fine, and then we have to peel back the layers of like, are we really? Anyway, that's probably a conversation for another time. But you mentioned just then parenting as a partnership, which I think is a really interesting way to frame that relationship because, you know, parenting can, you know, we are in charge as parents, right? And so it doesn't feel like a partnership. It feels like a leader and a follower. So I'd love to hear more about your thinking around framing the parent-child relationship as a partnership.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful way to frame educator-child relationship, educator-caregiver relationships. Like, everyone actually wants the same thing. They want kids to do well. They want to feel successful in the things that matter to them. But I think we're just butt heads a lot because of poor understanding of what's going on, what's behind things. A lot of us are quick to frustration. We're insecure about, you know, how good we are at this stuff. So it makes us hostile towards anything that makes us feel like we're failing at it. But yeah, we look at partnerships and everything we do. And that's what Mental Health First Aid tells us as well, is that if someone is struggling and we can feel like we're standing next to them as opposed to standing in front of them and we're trying to face the same stuff with them and saying, I'm sorry you're having a hard time like right now, how can I help, is a really beautiful comparison to like, why are you like this? What's going on? You know, I can't believe you're doing this right now. I just need you to listen to me. Like, those are the things that challenge partnerships, and we actually then fail and get what you're talking about, which is what it's actually called, is a negative coercion cycle, where it's one of us is trying to win. And it's just, even when you win, you haven't really won because you've wired in your brain or the kid's brain, screaming until I get the lollipop will get me the lollipop, or threatening to take away the iPad will stop them screaming. They're not great strategies.
And it feels bad. It feels terrible. Talking about behavior management, parenting, can you give me an idea of how pressing a concern behavior management is with parents and kids right now?
Yeah, it's really big. So, I mean, at a simple level, we know that a quarter of parents nationally say that every single day they're stressed by their child's behavior. We also know that, you know, behavioral problems in the classroom are the number one reason that teachers are leaving the profession. The amazing thing about those statistics is that there's so much we can do when we actually understand what the experience the kid is having and what we can do about it and where the evidence sits. So it's a really big issue. We know that kids are actually going worse. I was in Canberra a couple of weeks ago helping ERASI, UNICEF and Mindaroo launch the State of Australia's Children, which shows more kids are entering school with developmental risk, increasing family violence in homes, less kids are being read to. Like, there's a lot of stress that's in the community and families and schools at the moment, but and it is impacting kids' behaviour and the reality of people supporting them. But there's so much we can do when we actually understand where to put our resources and where to put our efforts.
Billy, those stats you could just kind of reeled off and talking about what a high level of concern it is, behavior. What's behind that? What do we know about the conditions of today that makes it such that the parents are struggling and the kids are struggling like this?
Yeah, well, there's a lot less support in the community. There's a lot more isolation. Families, you know, don't feel as connected to the broader community. They might not have extended family around them as much as the generations of our parents did. There's a lot more financial pressure. One in six kids in this country lives in poverty. There's a lot of things that make it really hard to do what you just did, which is reflect on how I'm going. A lot of people are just trying to survive and get through every day. And there's a collective responsibility in the community that we need to do better. We shouldn't let families or educators feel like they're on their own. And that's, I think, the biggest driver that's happening at the moment, is all the protective factors that we know for kids, like a sense of belonging in school, participating in community traditions, one person that makes me feel safe, quality friendships, two non-parental adults to have a genuine interest in me. All of those things are what I look for in clinic, not diagnoses and starting medication. That's often what people think they're coming to see me for, but often I just try and understand what experience the kid's having and how can I help.
Dr. Billy is a developmental pediatrician at one of Australia's largest pediatric hospitals. He's got over 20 years' experience working with kids. You might recognize his voice from the Pop Culture Parenting Podcast, a really popular show, and he's also the author of a book called 10 Things I Wish You Knew About Your Child's Mental Health. He's also a dad of three. He's got some practical experiences there as well. And we're talking about parenting turning turning points and managing your relationship with your kids while also trying to get the best behavior out of them. Did you have a moment, a light bulb moment, where you thought, oh, I need to change what I'm doing here because it's not working? Tell me about it. And also tell me whether you felt like you had the resourcing and the support to walk through that change and really make it make a difference. Billy, you just said that you part of what you do is try to figure out what's going on with the kid, and it's not necessarily a fix of medication. How do you begin that when you're in clinic? Is it a bit like detective work?
Yeah, it is a little bit. Yeah, it's nice to think of myself as a detective, but it is. It's really just about most of it, figuring it out, is the story of the kid, actually. It's like, what's their story been? You know, since even before they were born, we know how much the pregnancy environment influences developing little brains. And then what was it like when they came out? And what's their experience been? How much have they succeeded in the world? You know, how do they feel about themselves? Even little kids, what's their self-esteem like? You know, a lot of toddlers struggle with this stuff, but trying to think about, you know, really just putting ourselves in this kid's shoes, knowing that they're not waking up every morning trying to make everyone's life difficult, and thinking about what skill are they missing. That's most of what I'm doing, is thinking about what skill set are they missing, because we fall into traps of being like, you're this old now, you should have figured this out, or, you know, things like that. But as you know, a lot of us still struggle with things like emotional regulation and social relationships in our adult life. So I think we just put too much weight on little kids to be able to do this on their own. And I often find myself using the analogy of, you know, we teach kids to ride a bike by trying to make it fun with no pressure, celebrating them, trying to support them when they fall over. But if you kind of walk past a parent who was in a park trying to teach a kid to ride over and was saying, I can't believe you fell off again, get back up, why are you not listening to me? You know, you'd kind of go, that's not a great way to teach a kid how to ride a bike. But with social and emotional development, that's often how we do it.
Yeah, it's so interesting, Billy, that kind of incidental eavesdropping that you hear sometimes with parent-child interactions. And it strikes me that language is so important, the way we characterize certain actions, or even, I think, possibly incorrectly ascribe motivations to why kids are doing what they're doing, when that isn't the motive after all.
Yeah, definitely. I think it is. We unintentionally kind of can put narratives around kids that aren't positive as well. Like when, you know, even the simple language stuff of like just saying we, you know, we're trying to get better at this, you know, we are really working on this, as opposed to you need to get better at sharing with your brother, or you need to listen to the teacher better. You know, even simple stuff like screen time. We often meet families that are like, they just won't get off this phone and things like that. And we think about, well, what's a family strategy that's going to work? And instead of trying to stop doing something, thinking about what can we do together that's positive and strengths-based, such as, let's just make sure that for 20 minutes every day we do something where we're all enjoying it and connecting. It's not a chore. It's just to actually enjoy each other. And I think a lot of the time in clinic, I ask families, when did you last enjoy your child? And for some families, it's years. You know, they haven't kind of realized that that's actually part of the path through it, is trying to think, does this kid feel celebrated and unconditionally loved? And every family, every parent feels like that, but we know a lot of kids don't feel like that. And that's actually what we're aiming for, is how does the kid feel that there's unconditional love and support around them, and that we really celebrate them and we're so passionate just about who they are and not trying to change them.
And so how do you balance treating the child who is actually your patient, but also speaking to the parent and in a way treating them as well and trying to counsel them on changing their behavior?
Yeah, I validate their experience. So I validate how hard that must be. I share my own story. We use a therapeutic strategy of self-disclosure. I'm not one of those clinicians that sits there and says, how does that make you feel? I talk about how it makes me feel. I talk about, you know, the challenges that I have. I say that I'm really sorry that this is happening to you. I can see how hard you're trying to support your child. And it's often not about parents trying harder. It's often about dropping demands that are around them, increasing the support that's around them, and then trying to find energy that they can put into strategies that will actually help. And it's also not about shaming them. I think there's a lot of shame in like, well, it's because you're on the phone all the time. It's because you let them have access to social media. You know, it's because you're putting your own needs first sometimes, you know, or even simple stuff like, there's a lot of shame around things like sticker charts and things like that, because that's a behavioralist approach. And we use a humanistic approach, which is really what's going on for the kid. But I think too many of us are really nervous about how much we'll be judged about how we parent.
Sticker chart as in tracking good behavior and bad behavior?
Yeah, like some people will use it as a reinforcing tool and say this is, you know, that's a very what we call conditioning approach, mm-hmm. is like if you do this thing, I will give you a sticker, or I'll give you this and I'll reward you. And it can help and it can be good, especially if you're all doing it together. The problem is it's an extrinsic motivator. It's a motivator that's outside of you. But we know that behavior change and self-esteem and all that stuff comes from the kid feeling good about what they're doing and what they're succeeding, and not the goal, the actual process. So I can see how much effort you're putting into this, and you should feel really proud about yourself because I can see you getting better at riding the bike. I can see you getting better at sharing with your sister. I can see you getting better at trying to regulate how you're feeling so that you're not throwing stuff all the time, as opposed to you're perfect at it now, I'll give you the toy.
This time of year, that makes me think of the old Elf on the Shelf that comes out. And have you got take on the Elf on the Shelf, Dr. Billy?
I've got a quick take on Christmas.
Please.
I said this to my daughter. Yeah, I was talking to my daughter in bed. She's four. And I was talking about Christmas, and I started getting into that, like, you know, naughty or nice thing. And I actually said to her, I started talking about it, and then I caught myself. And like you said, beautifully, things like us saying sorry. But I caught myself, and I was like, actually, gorgeous, no matter what, you're going to get presents because you're amazing as you are. The interesting thing about that is I know a lot of people will listen to it and be like, oh, this person's just getting walked over.
Yeah.
And my vulnerability is permissiveness. My vulnerability is because of my own experiences. I don't want to be there because I said so. But I also understand that that's not where her behavior is going to come from, is that Santa's only going to give you presents if you're good. It's what I want to work on is the specific stuff that she's struggling with, which is emotional regulation and social development. And that's so many kids that are entering school, and she will be soon. And so I put specific stuff in place to support her to get better at emotionally regulating and, you know, and her social development.
Interesting hearing you say that you're a permissive parent, because I think I've gone on the journey of becoming a permissive parent.
I fall really into it. I think boundaries help kids feel safe. So yeah. Kids need to have boundaries and need for us to feel like they need to feel like we're in control and that they don't have authority and they don't have all the power, because I meet a lot of kids in clinic that's their story.
Yeah.
Because of what's happened is the parent is just, it can't put any rules in place. And those kids are often really lost in terms of their emotional regulation because they haven't got the firm boundaries.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a balance. It's a dance. Rose in Nara, Melbourne, welcome. You're in a step family situation. Tell me about the kind of tricky situation that arises as a result.
Well, I was in it. It's over now. The children are grown up, but I had stepchildren from the ages of 3 and 5, and my daughter was 4 at the time. And they came to me with different boundaries. I would say no boundaries in terms of behavior. They were acting out because their parents' marriage had been bad for a long time. And I just tried to change that, make them feel safe, secure. But, you know, as the stepmother, I was constantly told, you're not my mother, you can't tell me what to do, that sort of stuff. And unfortunately, the father wasn't very good at setting boundaries. And the mother was so upset and so unhappy, and I suppose jealous about me being parent. We had them 50% of the time. So she undermined everything I did. It was a terrible, awful situation for 15 years.
Wow, that sounds really tricky.
It was heartbreaking.
Were you ever able to chart any successes or developments in that journey? Did you ever feel like you made progress in that relationship?
I know I made progress in that relationship. I had a good relationship with the boys. They trusted me and they respected my boundaries, even though they pushed against them. It was clear they understood it was what I was doing was okay. And I think I saved them. I think I made them, you know, the parents were incapable of putting the interests of the children first. And that was a family report. That was a psychologist who interviewed everybody who said that. Mm. Whereas the boys knew that I was safe, I was predictable. But then when my daughter was 16, the situation was just so difficult that we needed to move out and go back to my home, which I had managed to keep, and we lived there and still carried on the relationship with the husband. But then the relationship with the husband broke down, and now we're going through a very difficult financial settlement.
Well, Rose, that is a lot that you've been through, a lot of challenges there. Thank you so much for sharing. Billy, as the calls come in, I just want to come to you for a quick comment, a reflection of what you heard in Rose's call.
Yeah, really, you know, hard stuff, but there's beautiful sanctuary in it. You know, I think that a lot of the kids, they do sense the people that are really there for them are the ones that have boundaries. And often step parents have a really hard time, but I see a lot of these kids when they have a lot more autonomy and they're entering adulthood, they often come back to these key figures in their life that supported them because they're able to reflect and go, yeah, you were hard on me, but I actually understand why now. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, for a lot of parents and step parents and coaches and educators, just being on the sideline and cheering for these kids is really important because you just want them to occasionally look around and say, hey, that person actually cared, and that's how they showed me that they cared. And it's what a lot of us, Beverly, I'm sure you're the same, you're aiming for a point where, like, when our kids don't need us anymore, they still come to us.
Yeah.
And we earn that through thousands of repetitions of failing and succeeding over years and years, not that one conversation we have on the end of the bed with them when they're leaving home and saying, you know, you can always come back to me.
Yeah.
So it's amazing to hear that person's done that for.
Yeah, that will be a beautiful moment when that happens one day in the future. Not right now, though. Joe in Boronia, Victoria, calling in on 1-300-222-5576. Joe, you have a question. What is it?
Yeah, hi. Thank you very much for having me. My husband has a long-term mental illness. And his behaviour over her childhood growing up, she's now in her late teens, has been challenging, and he's modelled unhelpful behaviours because of his thinking. And because of that, sometimes when I've gone to be the parent, he's undermined my opinion, which is in a negative way. Now, my daughter has grown up to have an opinion, which is great, and I wanted her to have a say, but I'm finding it difficult to give her advice. She shuts me down all the time when I try to talk to her now because she's seen my husband not necessarily respect me on the same page. And I really want to, you know, break that cycle.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people listening can relate to that, Joe. Dr. Billy, I know you can offer only general advice, but welcoming you into Dr. Yeah. Joe. Yeah.
Yeah, Joe, yeah, it's a really common experience, and we often hear this kind of confusion for a lot of teenagers because one parent's saying one thing and doing another thing, you know, and a lot of that. And so we try and think about, like, how can we be on the same page? I think that, you know, you shouldn't push down your own feelings, and it's really important. One part of, there's really three components of emotional development for kids. It's how we support their own emotions when they're struggling. It's how we role model and be honest and open about our own emotional difficulties. And then it's how we build emotional capacity when everyone's calm. And we don't really talk about emotions either deeply in schools or, you know, deeply in homes, because we kind of just think, oh, we'll just wait until they're melting down or I'm having a tough time. But I think it is, you know, an important thing that you do say, hey, look, I'm having a tough time. This is really impacting me. It's really important you have a voice, but we're battling and it's really stressing me out. And what we know from evidence around conflict resolution is that saying objectively what happens, how it makes you feel, and the need that is not being met for you, my need is that we are connected, we have a positive experience, I feel like you know how much I love and support you, and that comes back to me. And then making a request, do you just mind if from now on we try and work on that? We don't demand, we don't force it, because then that we're looking at compliance, which is what Beverly started talking about in the session. And if you can just make sure that you really share your experience and then try and think about what are achievable ways to build a better partnership with our kids, that's almost the most important thing to focus on. And it goes back to what we were saying, you know, we should be doing better than this. We shouldn't be having such a tough experience. And the hardest thing in clinic is getting parents to prioritize their own mental health. So I see that frequently too.
Joe, I hope that helps. And thank you so much for calling and sharing, asking a question of Dr. Billy. Dr. Billy Garvey is my guest. He's from Pop Culture Parenting. His book is called 10 Things I Wish You Knew About Your Child's Mental Health. And he's a developmental pediatrician with 20 years of experience working with kids and families. If you want to call and ask a question or share your parenting turning point? Was there a moment where you thought, oh, geez, what I'm doing is not working and I need to change this? And also as a backup, as a follow-up to that, did you feel like you had the support and resources you needed to make those parenting changes? Dr. Billy, something that has come up a bit, but I think deserves exploring in its own right, is this idea of emotional regulation, which if you read your book, you know, there's a lot of time spent with that. But I think it's a pretty important concept. Can you talk about what it is and why it's significant?
Yeah, definitely. So what we talk about really in clinic is co-regulation. So self-regulation, being able to handle our emotions on our own, is built hopefully through childhood and the ability of people to feel like someone helped them through co-regulation. And that's the kind of what we really look at as a strategy that's actually helpful. I think about it as essentially a five-step process. And the first is thinking about how am I actually going in this moment? Because often when our kids are kicking off and really struggling, we don't do that. And there's a way that we do that. Interoception is the one that we teach, which not what is happening in the world around me, but what's happening internally for me. And you have to actually practice that to go, actually, I'm getting really stressed and I'm feeling really tense and I'm feeling really hot. And how can I bring that back down so that I can go to this kid? And then as we're going to the kid, we want to try and think about what's going on for them. We train our fellows in being curious about their experience. And then before we want to regulate their emotions, we're just trying to connect with them. And a lot of that's non-verbally, just trying to get down, eye contact, eyes at level or lower. If we are speaking, it's open questions, it's slow, it's soft and it's gentle. And saying things like, I'm so sorry you're having this experience, I want to help you. Thinking about co-regulation is actually a neurophysiological process where our brains and our bodies, including our heart rate, get in sync together. A lot of the research is built off new mums and babies, but we know that through pair bonding, especially if you really know someone like educators and caregivers, you have the ability to regulate them by being calm yourself and then connecting. And then when we do all of that and we connect the child back down and we validate their experience and we have true what's called compassionate empathy, which is not just I understand what experience you're having, I also feel it and I want to help. And then when they're calm, then we think about setting limits and then we think about problem solving. And a lot of people jump a lot of those steps and they come in with limit setting and problem solving, whereas you know that's not helpful. If you come home and say, I've just had the worst day at work, and I go, well, it'll be better tomorrow, or, okay, let's fix it, let's get you a new job, or, you know, do that. What you want is someone to actually be like, hey, that sucks, I'm really sorry you're having that experience. And we just don't do that with kids enough, because that's how you actually build their capacity for them to actually have those emotional experiences and regulate them in a healthy way.
Yeah, parenting experts talk about three different kinds of parenting styles: authoritarian, authoritative, and permissive. Can you run us through what those mean?
Yeah, there's a fourth as well, which is neglect. Oh. And so there's two dynamics. One is warmth and the other is demand. So neglect is the worst one, and that's low demand, low warmth. So I don't care. I've got nothing that I expect of you, but I also am not that interested in you. And that's neglectful parenting, and it's the most destructive to kids' development. Authoritarian is the one where it's high demand but no warmth, and that's the I'm the law, because I said so. A lot of us grew up with that, and that really impacts kids' sense of autonomy, and they often will struggle with having their own voice in later years. Permissiveness is high warmth and no demand. I just want to be your friend. And a lot of those kids will struggle with authority later in life with educators. All three of those styles increase likelihood of mental illness and problems in kids in their development. The one we're actually aiming for is an authoritative approach, which is high demand, which is hopefully me, and a lot of us are trying to achieve this. I'm going to expect a lot of this child, but I'm going to do it with them. I'm going to give them an understanding. I'm going to give them an increased level of autonomy as they keep succeeding. And when they ask why, I'm going to try and help them understand. I'm not going to say things like, because I said so. And that's where all the evidence sits across cultures of giving our kids the best chance to reach their potential.
Well, that's a good point that you make, Billy, because parenting is also cultural, you know, whether you talk about your feelings or the role of the mum and dad and their ways of interacting with children can be highly codified and dictated by culture, which then comes along with expectations. Are you raising the child, you know, in the cultural way properly? How do you try to help people modify their parenting styles in the face of so many other factors, including social pressure?
Yeah, I mean, we do it in an intentional way. We're trying to weave the evidence into storytelling, the journeys that we have, the narratives, playfulness, like Pop Culture Parenting, the book. When we go out to communities, we go and speak to corporates about this stuff. We go into schools and we connect with them. Because just like the process that I've taken you through there, we have to connect with someone and understand their experience and really show that compassionate empathy before we can get behavior change. And then I've never met a parent in now over 25 years that doesn't have a strength. And I often try and find that strength in that parent and then guide them through just, hey, I can see how much this matters to you. What if we tried this instead? How about we give this a go? And I'm going to journey with you. I will say to families in clinic, I will see you and be support you as long as you want me to and as long as I'm helpful. And I'm very lucky to be in that setting in a public setting, in a public hospital, where I can say I'm on this journey with you. And that's how I do it. We also try and influence the biggest fears of cultural influence. Like, we know we use Pop Culture Parenting very intentionally because we know a lot of us grew up watching movies where masculinity was defined by someone just being tough, burying his feelings and going and punching the bad guy in the face. And really, like, characters like Batman are actually broken little kids that don't have good, healthy emotional regulation coping mechanisms.
Oh, so, yeah. Bruce Wayne, you know, he needs a lot of help, that guy.
He does. But he's had a significant childhood trauma, you know.
Absolutely. So much trauma underpins all those superhero backstories. Let's take another call. Cheryl's in Sydney. Some grandparenting challenges, Cheryl. What's going on?
I am the mother of twins. I had that experience, some time ago, and I'm also an educator, so I really relate to all the things that are being said. I have my granddaughter with me. I look after her. You can hear me now chatting in the background.
Hello.
But I am just trying to deal with her getting into her car seat in the car. So it's absolutely a not, like, she has to do it for her safety, as we all know. But she has been doing a full-on tantrum, straightening the back, refusing. And I've had to kind of, I've tried talking to her and saying that it's not set, that she has to do it, that I have to do it, so we need to do it to go in the car. It's the only way she can go in the car. But she's not, you can't really reason with a two-year-old. But, so I thought I would really appreciate some input on what would be the best way to manage that.
Cheryl, that straight back that you mentioned, that just really triggered me. I know exactly what you're talking about. Billy.
You're speaking to my soul, because we've got our four-year-old has just gotten to the point where she can successfully do it without anything from us. And now our two-year-old is kicking off and doesn't want to get in the car.
And my two-year-old here is just talking to me in the background, wanting to know what's going on.
Okay.
Yeah, beautiful. It's amazing. You're doing a phenomenal job of juggling things, and there's so many grandparents out there that are really protective, that are around kids. But so I'll give you something helpful. What we talk about is plan A, plan B. We talk about this in our Unsettled Babies Clinic, and we talk about it with the teens that are really struggling with antisocial behavior, of like, you've got a specific skill that you're trying to help a child get better at, which is transitioning into a car. Transitions are often tricky for kids, especially when it's one where they're going to lose physical autonomy. They're about to sit in a seat, they're not going to be able to move around and be as free as they would. So what you do is you think about plan A, plan B. Plan A is, we're trying to get better at this, and that's, let's try and make it fun. Let's see how good you can be at it. Let's build it as a positive experience that we do together. I'm going to race you to the car. Let's see if you can get your arms in before I get there. Let's do those things. And I'm not pretending that you try this once and it'll work, but you're trying to build in steps that are directing them towards the behavior you want. We're doing it together. We're celebrating it. We're putting fun in it. Repetition of that with a stretch that ideally most of the time they feel some sense of success. So, Nosh, you're going to get in perfectly. You're going to get the buckles lined up for me. You're going to say thank you and tell me how much you love me, and we're going to talk about the 10 things you loved about today. You'll fail. Right. But if you get that stretch in just a little way of race me to the car at first, or let's see if you can jump up before I can lift you up, those type of things, and then they start to feel empowered. They're getting that autonomy. They're getting that expression. There's also plan B, and I do plan B. Plan B is, we're running late. I'm just going to pick you up and you're going to kick off at me. You're going to be kicking me. You're going to be shouting and all those things. There's also plan B of, I'll give you the iPad if you'll jump in for me because I'm so stressed. I just need to get you in the car. The problem is they get better at it through plan A. we survive and get through the day by plan B.
Yep.
So you want plan A to be happening, you know, 60% of the time, just tipping it over to it. But give yourself a break as well of like, I've had such a bad night's sleep. We're actually running late. I don't have the ability to regulate my own emotions first, like we talked about. And you just go, I'm going to do whatever it takes. And actually giving yourself a pass for that is really important.
We're going to go to Canberra, where Larissa is standing by. What do you want to say about a parenting turning point?
A parenting turning point for me was when my son, who's now 30, was 8 months old, and I attended a parenting course, and it was a parenting course really on respectful relationships and respectful communication skills, and it was parent effectiveness training, and it just changed my life, and I think the life of my kids and the outcome.
What prompted you to seek out that course, Larissa?
A friend couldn't do it, so she said, do you want to do this parenting course? And I had, you know, I was 30. I'd never held a baby. I might have held a baby once. I didn't know anything about being a parent. We're not in a, you know, I was in a nuclear family. No one had babies around us. So parenting, I thought, was a good idea, but this course just turned me from one way to the other.
What was something that you went in thinking about being a parent that changed as a result of going through that course?
Okay, so I was brought up the traditional, so-called traditional way with rewards and punishment. And this course said, you don't need to do that. You don't need to punish. You don't need to control behavior through punishment. So, which was like pretty eye-opening and a change for me. I remember my mum saying, you'll learn that one day you'll have to smack. But I never did. I never even punished. So what I learned instead was how to listen to hear the needs of my child. And it's amazing how things dissipate once kids feel understood and heard. I learned how to put my needs across, which I suppose is like a boundary, but using I messages, like I feel concerned when I see these toys on the floor that I'm going to hurt myself if I step on them. Rather than saying, you need to pick those toys up, which is a you message and a blameful message. So I learned what not to do, and that was really important. And I learned conflict resolution. So I actually learned to see children as people, and that's like a really sad revelation.
Mm.
And
beautiful.
I learned that, and this was another, I'm just rambling, but this was another turning point. I learned that it helped me see that children don't misbehave, but what they're doing is a signal to us that they have a need that needs to be met. And then that just turns the way that I look at things around, and it helps me take away, like the I messages, you were talking about motivation, I call it intention. Like, it helps me stop attributing intent to the child if I truly listen and if I use I message to talk about my needs.
Larissa, we have to move on, but I really appreciate your story. It sounds like that course 30 years ago was a massive turning point for you. And I think it's so helpful for you to share what you have learned. Billy, we've got a few more calls, but I think I'd love to hear your comment on what Larissa has shared.
Yeah, it's amazing. I don't think I've ever agreed with what someone says more in a lot of time doing this. So, and it's funny because she said I'm rambling, but actually I've had about 5 or 6 points that she got across about our own needs, conflict resolution, you know, shifting away from authoritarian parenting, like amazing stuff. And we do, I'm trained in what's called tuning in. That might have been what she did as a parenting course, but we do parenting stuff in the community. We do it for free because corporates support us and other organizations support us like YMCA. So if communities are keen, reach out to Guiding Growing Minds, because we come and do this stuff and we talk about it and we meet parents that have those experiences like what Larissa's had. So it's wonderful. And the ability to be reflecting on it 30 years later is amazing.
Yeah. Let's take another call from Rebecca in Narm. Now, Rebecca, you're trying to navigate your two sons who have very different needs. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I've got a 14-year-old with ASD and ADHD, and my 16-year-old has ADHD and OCD. And the OCD as a 16-year-old, it just impacts, I guess, his everyday life. And therefore, he's actually triggered a lot by his younger brother, which I guess that causes the conflict. And then at the moment, we moved house in June, just the backstory, and his OCD ramped up as it always does when there's a change in his routine or life, and it just hasn't settled. So it's been much longer than normal, and I feel like I should be proactive, but he's just rejecting all of that. So I'm trying to allow his nervous system to just settle and live. But I mean, he won't touch door handles. He has 3 showers a day. And he refuses to go back to a psychologist for the last several years. And it's
tricky. Sounds like a struggle, Rebecca. Billy?
Yeah, I meet a lot of these kids in clinic, and it's really hard stuff because parents like you are just desperately trying to support them. And especially when you know they need clinical support, they need therapists, and that level of anxiety is really common. And they're often functioning, sometimes never leaving their room. Sometimes when they do, it's such high levels of distress. And what I would say is, like, go right back to that safety and go right back to, like, people we see, for example, in pathological demand avoidance, or a better descriptor is persistent demand for autonomy, which sits within autism. These kids are just really struggling that anything's being asked of them. So what we do is we strip it right back and just think about, how do you feel safe? How do we get your nervous system not just spiking all the time? And then how do you start feeling like that again in the world? And a lot of parents know that that's actually the path. A lot of people are like, well, no, we can't just ask nothing of them. But then you build it back up, just like we talked about the parenting style. Loving someone unconditionally and having high expectations of them are two completely different things, and they're not in conflict like a lot of people think about the gentle parenting approach. And so thinking about, how can I do that for these kids? How can I just pair it right back so that we're all just feeling safe and we're all just feeling like our needs are being met at that simpler level before we start stretching, because the stretch is too much at the moment. And thinking about what's a reason why this kid would connect with clinical services. A lot of the kids wait 3 years to see us, and we say, well, do you know why you're here? And they go, nah. And there's not, but often with the teenagers, what we build is that understanding of what matters to them. And then I will find ways. And a lot of kids will say, the reason I come to therapy is because I can keep my part-time job. And if I get my part-time job, I can save up for a car, and then I'm going to be able to get a car. They don't care about school. They don't care about what their grades are like. A lot of them, it's their social relationships. I do therapy and I take medication, because if I don't, I drive my mates crazy and I don't get invited to parties. And so that's an awesome thing to think about. What are the motivators for the kids that are in our lives? That it will always be different to what ours are. And so trying to connect with that, and I'm sure you're doing all those things, but that's the path through.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. You'll be our final caller for this session. Dr. Billy Garvey, before I let you go, any final thoughts from you, parents feeling overwhelmed, you know, with their situation, not knowing where to start? How should they begin?
I think how you begun. How am I going in this journey? What more support do I need? And it's not about asking more of yourself. It's about redirecting energy, taking energy out of other things and putting it towards the relationship, putting it towards our own mental health. I see a therapist. I need to see a therapist. I need to look after myself and do the things that keep me healthy and happy. And I'm a better parent because of it. And, you know, thinking about, we just want our kids to feel unconditionally loved and supported. And that's everything else comes off that foundation. So if I could change one thing about all the kids that I'm in clinic, it would be parents giving themselves a break and then just prioritizing that unconditional love and support.
Dr. Billy Garvey, thank you so much for generously sharing your time this morning. I know you're a busy guy.
thanks, Beverly.
Billy is
wonderful. I just get to do lots of this stuff.
And yeah. So thanks for helping. Well, come back in 2026. You're always welcome on this show. He's a developmental pediatrician at one of Australia's largest pediatric hospitals. He's the host of Pop Culture Parenting, the podcast, and author of the book 10 Things I Wish You Knew About Your Child's Mental Health. The aunties are standing by, so let's chuff on.
What happens when medicine is sold like a makeover? Clinics with 5-star reviews selling miracle cures.
I left that place thinking I found myself a solution.
But it's your body that pays the price.
I had one cheek higher than the other, one cheek further out from my nose.
Before and After, a new series on how medical hype spreads online, who profits and who pays.
Background Briefing, Sunday mornings at 9 on ABC Radio National, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Sometimes people's thinking and communication styles are so different to your own that it can feel like they're from another planet. And when those people are your in-laws, it is definitely time to ask Auntie.
Hey,
Helping you decode today's in-law culture clash, welcome to author and associate editor at Guardian Australia, Brady Jabor, and head writer for Gruen on the ABC, James Colley. Brady and James, let's get welcome to Auntie.
Hello, thank you. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. Hello. I know you both have in-laws, so tread carefully. Let's get to our letter writer, 36-year-old mom, Rachel. Let's kick off with what Rachel has to say. She says, my parents and I are incredibly close. We communicate easily about our emotions and are generally aligned in our thinking, which means navigating grandparent childcare, which they do a lot, has always been very easy and guilt-free. My partner's family lives in the UK and are about as far away from my family in terms of how they do things as they are in distance. But this month, because my parents were off duty for medical reasons, I suggested we invite my partner's mom to fly over and help fill the massive childcare gap. Initially, my partner was reluctant because of what he called our difficult relationship. And it's true that on past visits, I'd found her comments about my, quote, strong opinions and our daughter's, quote, out of control nature pretty frustrating. But I definitely wouldn't call our relationship difficult. I mean, what's a few snarky comments between family? And I figured my mother-in-law felt the same way because a call was made and a few days later, Marge was moving into the room next door for a six-week stay. Okay, Bridie, Rachel's given us a lot of detail. What's standing out to you?
Two things are standing out to me. One, I'm getting the impression that Rachel thinks that her way is the right way to communicate and that her family does it in the correct way and her in-laws do it in an incorrect way. And the other thing that stands out to me is that is a massive ask of your mother-in-law who lives on the other side of the world to come and live with you for 6 weeks. What a huge thing to ask someone of. And what a generous thing for her to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. James, thoughts thus far. Are you seeing any orange or red flags?
Yeah, I think that you have to understand that the comments you have heard from your mother-in-law through your husband are the ones that he has allowed past the keeper. And if those are the nice ones you have heard, the ones you haven't heard, like if he's saying, oh, I don't know about our relationship here, it's because there is more information going to one side of this relationship than the other.
Okay, so at this stage, you feel like Rachel's kind of missing the not reading the room.
Yeah, a little bit. I think like it could just be, you know, English culture clash of that level, but I feel like she might not have all the information she needed to have made an informed decision.
So, Bridie, what do you think of this comment? First of all, I'd love to know what you think about James, but also, you know, what's a few snarky comments between family? I mean, do you think there's more to it than that, as James alludes?
Well, I think that James is probably correct. There's more to it. But also that comment raised alarm bells for me in her not being able to see what that could mean to the other side of the family. Like, she thinks the way that her family does things is correct. That's one of the lines that made me think. She thinks she's all in the right. She thinks the way they do things are correct and the other family are incorrect or just have to deal with it. Like, a few snarky comments between families in different families, that's very significant. And that can mean a lot to certain people, and you need to understand that.
Yeah, very good insight. I like where this is going. Let's check back in with Rachel for her part two. So Rachel says, for the first few weeks, things seem to be going well. But then one morning, I told Marge about dinner plans with a close friend who was back from the UK for an extremely short visit. I assumed Marge would watch the kids, but she said, oh, I'd love to come. I was slightly thrown and blurted out, oh, I don't think you'd enjoy it, and the kids would love a night with you, and then went about my day. But the next morning at breakfast, Marge was visibly annoyed. So not wanting to be insensitive, I said, thanks so much for last night. I hope I'm not asking too much. Marge's reply, actually, since the moment I got here, you've been ordering me around like an au pair. I find you incredibly bossy, intimidating, and domineering, and all you do is exclude me. But unfortunately, you have my son and my grandchildren, so here I am. Bridie, please come in. What do you make of these comments of Marge's? Incredibly bossy, intimidating, domineering, excluding. You have my son and grandchildren, so here I am.
Well, Rachel did just describe herself treating her mother-in-law like the au pair. Like, that's exactly what she was doing. She made plans, then was telling her mother-in-law about the plans, saying and assuming you look after the kids like it's her job. Like, I understand getting your mother-in-law over for a childcare gap when you're working, but if you want to go out and socialize and have fun, I think that the right thing to do is ask, would it be okay with you if you watch the kids while I go and do this fun thing? And also, I think it made me a bit sad, the element, like the exclusion, feeling excluded really stands out to me there, because she describes her mother-in-law perking up and thinking she's invited to something. And so obviously she is sitting there waiting to be invited to something and would like that.
Yeah.
And then told, no, you're the au pair, you're the babysitter, you're just here at my convenience and I'm not even going to ask you to look after the kids. I'm just going to assume you're doing it around the clock.
Yeah, 6 weeks in a foreign country taking care of kids is not a holiday by any means. But I would just say, you know, on Rachel's behalf, that is exactly the deal that Marge agreed to.
Well, but to the socialising, because I think that I can understand agreeing to look after the kids with working, covering work, but did she agree to be on call 24/7? Okay. Like when people just want to go out to dinner?
So it sounds like, Bridie, you're more team Marge at the moment. James, can you see Rachel's perspective at all?
I can absolutely see Rachel's perspective as someone who fumblingly tries to exclude their in-laws from things in a similar way. You went about it the wrong way. Like this was completely backwards, which, as Bridie mentioned, the ask of this to say the next day, I hope it was okay. That's not how that conversation goes. The conversation has to start with, hi, is it okay if you do this? Because like Grace said, she started describing a really fun evening and then was like, by the way, you're not invited. I want you to take care of these children. And I think you have to understand as well with, like, we are talking about an English mother-in-law. For her to say that speech that was recounted, that wasn't a spur of the moment, oh, I'm a bit miffed, here's what I'm going to let out. She would have rehearsed that in her head 4,000 times, squeezing that out. That is blood from a stone to get emotional honesty out of an older generation English person. How bad has this deteriorated?
Okay, well, let's find out, okay, because we've got 3 minutes and Rachel's still got a final chapter. So here we go. Marge's explosion left me completely floored. I'm already hyper-conscious of how clearly non-fluent I am in repressed Anglo, so I apologize profusely. After that, she and my partner both magically went back to acting like nothing happened. I know I could do the same, especially since Marge is due to leave next week. And usually I've got a pretty thick skin, but these comments cut deep, especially since I thought the visit had been going well. If this blowout happened in my family, I'd dive straight into its messy guts and work it out. But I get the sense Marge just wants to move on because she once told me nothing good has ever come from a conversation about feelings. If I don't say something, I think the relationship will falter and it's on me to arrange her visit, so that will be awkward. Aunties, Bridie, tell me, we've got just a little bit of time left. What do you make of this final chapter? People kind of dusting things under the rug and moving on. Is that healthy?
I think that what you really need to do in this kind of dynamic is reflect on your role in it. If you really want to repair, and I'm not saying that Marge has behaved perfectly or Marge is in the right and Rachel is in the wrong. There's not goodies v. baddies. There are two people in a dynamic. I think Rachel needs to reflect on her role in it and really think properly and confrontingly about the past 6 weeks and how she may have come across, how she treated Marge, and then think about what to do. Because there's even a judgmental tone in that, like, I'm not fluent in repressed Anglo. That's judgmental. You're not coming to this with emotional honesty and thinking about your role in it. You still think this is Marge's fault.
If you were Rachel, how would you have that conversation with Marge?
I would start with a profuse apology.
She did that.
No, that's not after Marge blew up. That's in the moment. And that's also apologizing over one thing the night before. But it's obviously been boiling up before then. I think it's a real full-hearted, proper apology. I don't really think there was a proper apology in the moment that's happened.
James, time is short, but I want to know what your final words of advice to Rachel would be.
I do speak repressed Anglo and you don't speak. Go take her out. You described a nice night out and she was thrilled and excited at the prospect of being out with you. Go do that. Go show her that she is appreciated and you recognize how these weeks have only been possible because of the sacrifice she made. Do something. Like, she clearly actually wants to hang out with you. Hang out with her.
I love these two different perspectives from the aunties. Thank you both so much for jumping in and sharing your perspectives. Brady Jabor is associate editor at Guardian Australia. James Colley is head writer for Gruen on the ABC. The email to write to Life Matters is abc.net.au. We will get the aunties on the case. That email address again is lifematters@abc.net.au. Just pop Ask Auntie in the subject line. Big thank you to Life Matters producers who bring you all the stories and interviews you hear across the week. They work very, very hard to bring this program to you. They are Jordan Bissell, Grace Pashley, Kate Ubergang, Beck Zajac, and Max Rowley. And our executive producer is Lachlan McIntosh. Audio engineer is Carrie Dell, and you can find all Life Matters episodes on the ABC Listen app. I hope you have already downloaded it, but if you haven't, all is forgiven. Just hop on over to your app store, download the hot pink app, search for Life Matters, tap the heart to follow, you're all set. I'm Beverly Wang. Thanks for all your calls and messages. I'll catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.